Hi, I'm Richard, the founder of 10 Adventures, and you're listening to the 10 Adventures podcast. We are more than just a travel company. We are a community of active explorers who have been inspired by the outdoors. Join me as I sit down with real people to talk about their most epic adventures on this incredible planet. Welcome back to the 10 Adventures podcast. One of the most fascinating countries to travel to is India. And while many listeners have probably spent time in India, what we're going to hear about today is a totally different part of India that is not only hidden from most travelers, but is also hidden from most Indians. I'm excited to have Ash Joshi on the podcast today to talk about his book, Journey to the East, which chronicles his 1,800-kilometer expedition across India from the Arabian Sea to the Bay of Bengal. Hi, Ash. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
What a great journey this was. And it was really interesting reading excerpts of the book that you'd released to see this different part of India that I've never knew existed. But going back to the start, what led you in the decision to walk across India?
So first of all, thanks for reading what I've sent you. But I think it all started off when I was in England. I was going through activism rows. I was a university student. I was going through activism rows, and we were working for newspapers and magazines and trying to protest outside of the 10 Downing Street. And it felt like something was missing. I didn't know what it was at that time, but I felt like there wasn't a change happening. There wasn't really anything happening with what we were doing. It all felt like virtual at that point. And I'm not saying that people who do protests are not changing anything. They obviously change a lot of conscience of the people around them. But it felt like I needed to do something else. I needed to understand it in a very different way. And there was something happening in India at that time. It was the farmer protests. The government had brought a bill in India which took out a lot of things from the farmers, and they were not given the right kind of MSP, which is money that they get for giving their goods to the government. And they were protesting for a long time. And I thought this is the right thing to do. But at the same time, something else was happening from the state that I come from, which is Maharashtra, where I'm right now. I was looking at the graphs, and it was fascinating because there were over 3,000 people who were committing suicide every single year for the last 10 years. And I just wanted to understand what this was and why this was happening. And that's where it all kind of came together, and I decided I should head off.
So it seems a really interesting topic you want to explore. A lot of people would have gotten in a car and driven around. You decided to do this big walk. Why was the walk important in understanding these problems?
Yeah, so I think there is, first of all, if you are going on a bike or in a car or something like that, you don't have enough time to spend with the people. A lot of time what happens is people put on different faces, and at the same time they also try to show their best selves when you're coming in a car or something, because they feel like you are some important guy from the city. Just because the villages in India are very different to what villages might look like in England or somewhere else. And so the best way to go about it was to do a walk, because you have a very slow pace of life. You have time to meet people. You have time to discuss about their issues. You have time to listen for yourself, which is very important, I think. And then you also have time to contemplate on what you have heard, which normally doesn't happen when you're on a bike, because you can move away from that situation very quickly. You can just go to the next city and you have forgotten about it. So I think walking helped me to have that very intense connect with the people that I really wanted to meet at that point.
You mentioned about village life being different in India versus the UK. And actually, when I was reading the book, one thing I found was here in Canada, I spent all my summers on a farm. And it felt like the farm and the nearby towns and cities, it was pretty similar. But my impression is farms and, you know, rural life and urban life in India is really, really different. Can you maybe talk a little bit about the differences of, you know, rural life and these farms you were going through?
So what different, you know, the way I can put it is, so I was living in Huntly, Aberdeenshire in Scotland for some while.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it was the COVID kind of first lockdown time. And I think I had to make a very quick decision of going back to India, which was very difficult because the government was asking for a lot of money to get back on the flight that was coming to India. And so I just thought, you know, why not just explore the weirdest option that I could get over here? And so I went to Huntly, and I lived there at a very slow pace of life. And I really understood what life looks like in a village in England. And one thing I can say is that technology plays a very important role in the Western society in general. Even if you're in an urban landscape or if you're in a rural landscape, everyone is using their phones and laptops and iPads everywhere. In India, and most importantly, everyone in the West has gone through the technological evolution in a very systematic kind of manner, where they went from post to the telephone, where you were ringing, moving the dial, to your phones, to cordless, today, where you have an iPhone in your hand. And in India, in most of the places, it's not like that. Most of the places that I've visited, people don't even use a phone. They have no sort of communication other than actually going out and meeting the people. And that's the different side of India. The other thing is the technology, how it evolved in India, is that it went from nothing to the dialing phones and directly to WhatsApp. And so there is no in between. And because of the lack of infrastructure, there are so many people who don't use the phones. And that is why you have a very different sort of lifestyle which you get in India. I think that's what is different about a Western village and an Indian village, that you have a much more community-driven, community-based. You have to go out and meet people, and you're asking for, if you don't have sugar, you go to the next house and you ask them for sugar. And it's never like, it's never odd for them, I think.
It's really interesting just to consider the pace of information coming in, and with our smartphones and being connected, we kind of know what's going on a minute-by-minute basis here in Canada and in the UK and in the big cities in India. But it's interesting to think of, in a small village where, you know, maybe only a couple people have smartphones, the ability to kind of be on top or even care about current events is a lot less. And so it just, you know, it's actually kind of a nostalgic feeling. As you were talking, I was thinking, oh, that's what I like about going to, here in the Rockies, these backcountry lodges where there's no cell phone service and you're kind of out of contact for a week. But it would be totally different if I had that for year after year. Like, I can now understand a little bit better the variance between the village life and the urban life. I want to talk a little bit about the route you took. And so, you know, obviously I understand the starting point and the ending point, but can you maybe talk through the types of places you went through on your 1800 kilometers?
Yeah, so I took a very unconventional route than what most people would go. Also because I was going through areas which were drought ridden, and most of the times the temperature were 45 degrees plus in most of the places that I walked through. So it's very difficult to place, but if you put the Indian map and if you draw a line in between, that's where I literally walked from the western shore to the eastern shore. But there was Pandharpur, if people if people have been to India, if they know devotional sort of places, there's Pandharpur where I went through. And one thing that I realized was, it was very shocking for me because the religious significance of that place is just lost at this point, because people don't really care about, you know, it was all about nature, because there was a river flowing next to the temple, and that's where people sat down and meditated, and that's where you have all these stories coming from. And that river is completely filled with plastic. It's completely filled with dirt. And one of the shocking like images that I've took during that journey is of a nomadic girl, very, very young, I think 8-9 years old, and she's just sifting through the plastic and the clothes that I've washed all out, so that she can find something useful that she can go out and get some money for it. So that was one of the experiences that I had over there. Then I walked through a place which was infiltrated with Naxalite infiltration, which is kind of like that place is called as the Red Corridor of India. That is because it is kind of the communist bloc of India. So that is not really governed by the Indian state. So it's in the middle of India. It's a huge forest, which is very old. It has lots of wildlife inside of it. And when the Britishers were in India, they tried to use this place as, you know, forest replantation. They used to use that area to get wood out. And they never really tried to go inside the forest because, you know, people were living inside the forest. And, you know, there was no point in having that sort of a connection over there other than the hunts that they went on. But now, what happened was when India got independence, these people were still living inside. They still did not know anything about this. And what it was they were kind of the people who never really cared who was governing them. Because whoever governed the Indian state never really knew who these people were, and these people never knew who they were. And so after 1947, when Indian government started taking that land as its own, they started fighting back because they understood what was happening around them, that extreme industrialization and urbanization meant that killing of the forest. That's the easiest way to put it. And that's why they started fighting back. And it started becoming an armed rebellion after a while. And so I was brought into a police station before entering that place. And the police interrogated me, literally, trying to ask me if, you know, what I had in mind, because even the police and the military is not allowed to go inside that place. So I went, you know, I obviously told them what my objective was, and they were fine with it at the end of the day. And let me go. Knowing that if you get harmed or killed, that's not up to us because we tried to warn you. And I went inside, and the people were much nicer. You know, I just felt like I've been going through the past of the world, because there's no sort of urban infrastructure over there, no light, there's no water supply, no roads, nothing. You're in a forest living with nomadic people who have been living there for like thousands of years. So they helped me to cross the border from Chhattisgarh to from Maharashtra to the next state, which was Chhattisgarh, in a sort of canoe which was made out of wooden a single log of wood. So yeah, that it was an illegal crossing, but it was nevertheless, it was what it was.
And when I've flown over India, one thing I'm struck by is just how industrial it is. And you mentioned, you know, walking through industrialization, you look down, you see a village and a smokestack, I think, for making concrete bricks. And it seems like it's a really industrial environment. So I'm surprised to hear there's this big forest in the middle that there's no roads through. But in general, in your journey, did you have lots of time where you were kind of in nature, or was it mostly walking on roads and paths between kind of like small industrial, slightly industrialized villages?
I think most of it was walking through like roads and industrialized villages. Also, because in the last 10 years, the road network has developed a lot. And that means that you're walking mostly on cement roads, which are fairly new, newly built. I think that is also because there's a lot of emphasis given on getting a lot of material out of these forests now, because there's a lot of mines and whatnot, you know, all sorts of things that are happening to get all these resources out of these forests. And that's why you had a lot of industrialized kind of infrastructure that I was walking across on most of the parts. And these forests were just a small part of it. Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier, it was 45 degrees Celsius, which, you know, as a Canadian, it's almost unbelievable to think of that. Like when it gets above 30, we all just, you know, we do not go out and do hard walking. But so what was an average day like when you're walking in these extreme temperatures? You know, how do you deal with that? And then, you know, how did you plan your day out?
So most of the days I started out really early. So I would wake up at 4:30 and start at 5 in the morning. And then I would walk somewhere around like 9, 9:30, 10-ish. And then I'd just find a tree or a shade, wherever, whichever was there at that time. And I'd just rest. I'd just put all of my stuff, all of my belonging there. And I'd just sleep over there under the shade for how many hours I can. Or else if I was in a village, then I would just, go into the roadside shop and start chatting with the person over there. And everyone were fascinated for someone who was just walking around and they had no idea about, you know, something like this happening. And so I would just chat to them, or someone would invite me in their house and I would go inside, have tea. And, you know, it was the most pleasant experience that I had in the afternoon. And then obviously around like 3:30 or something, I'd start again, and so I'd start walking. And I never really had any place in mind where I need to sleep. But somewhere around 6:30, when it usually is dark in India, I would try to speak to as many people as I can. And they would usually ask me about where I'm going, what I'm doing, and Some people would definitely bring me in to their house and they would ask me to stay in their house, or else I'll just find a temple where I can just sleep inside the temple. I'll put my tent up and I'll sleep inside the temple because it's a free space for anyone, is what I had heard, growing up in India. And I wanted to test it out.
one thing that was really interesting is you had a unique way of transporting your gear. And I wonder if you can share a little bit about that, because it seemed like that also opened a lot of doors to talking to people.
Yes, definitely. Like I was actually watching a couple of adventurers, Leon McCorren and Alistair Humphreys, who walked across the Sahara. It's called Into the Empty Quarter. And another one was a Swiss guy who was walking from Switzerland to India, and he was carrying a trolley. And I felt like that's the right way to go about it. But I knew for sure that I wouldn't get the right kind of gear for it, whatever, when it comes to like the wheels or the kind of, you know, handles and anything that they were using, which was very advanced. And I'm pretty sure I wouldn't get in India. So I did what Indians call jugad. Jugad is basically like trying your way through and bringing out something together and fixing things up. So I asked a friend of my dad who manufactures heavy industry equipments for chemical factories. And I asked him, you know, I have this structure, can you build it for me? And he was excited by the walk itself, and so he did that entire trolley for free, and I got like an equipment that I can put all my gear in. So I had a backpack, a tent, bottles of water, sleeping mat, all that sort of stuff that I can put it on that. And I had a small plate which said Arabian Sea to Bay of Bengal, And everyone got excited when they just went past that trolley after watching that. And I really feel like that trolley was the center of attraction. And I think that's what people were really looking after. Not even me. No one really cared about me in most of the parts. Like, they would just look at the trolley and they would want to take it on a ride or something like that.
Hey everyone, this is Richard, and I just want to take 30 seconds to let you know that if you are enjoying these stories and are interested in embarking on your own adventure, then head over to 10adventures.com. At 10 Adventures, our specialty is booking private and custom active holidays. Jump straight from dreaming to doing without any of the hassle of travel planning in between. Join thousands of other travelers who have already booked with 10 Adventures to destinations in over 85 countries and experience more of what our planet has to offer while making memories that'll last a lifetime. Now back to the podcast. And so that opened some interesting ability to connect with locals. There's an interesting story about Suraj in your book, and I wonder if you can maybe share that. I found that really a really interesting story.
Yeah, okay. So the guy that you're talking about, I was in a place called Nanded, and I met a professor who was building a kind of hospital for people in the local areas who were nomadic people who could get help from those from the hospital over there. And he asked me if I could stay in that place, which was still in its initial stages. It was just a farmland which he was developing. And so I said yes, and I went to that place. And I got, there were two families. One of them were Surids and another one. But I got an instant, welcome from Suraj, and he brought me in and gave me chai, and we were sitting down having a chat about life in general. And he offered me some biscuits, and we started talking about, you know, what's happening in his life. And he started telling me his story. So he comes from a lower caste, but it's not really a lower caste. It's more of a nomadic kind of tribe that he comes from. And they are called Adivasis, who, like, people who lived in forest, basically. And what happened was all of these nomadic tribes had their own way of life. They had their own culture. They used to be going around and about. The closest you can come to it is Gypsy or Romani people, who don't have a place to stay, and they camp wherever they feel like. And that's the way of life that they had for the longest period of time. What changed was in 1947, India became independent, and suddenly these people found that they had no land for themselves, because now people owned land. And before that, even if people owned land, there was a lot of land which was left for them. And now the government owned land. It's very different to how a British person views government to how an Indian views government. Because here in India, people feel like government is a separate entity. It's nothing to do with us. So that's not our land. It's a government land. But people don't understand that it's publicly owned, which means it's ours. So what happened is these nomadic people had no land. And in 1975 or 76, there was a scheme which gave land to all these nomadic people. But it was such a small piece of land that you could barely build a house in that piece of land. And so if you don't have farming or anything, how are you going to sustain yourself? And so these people had to find a way to go out and do hard labor. And so Suraj's dad went out in this same manner, and Suraj's mom died prematurely when she was giving birth to Suraj, and so they were just running around the place all the time, building roads, building in some agricultural farm or something. And so Suraj never got education. He was just traveling around with his dad, never having a real kind of education, because the structure doesn't allow it. And the weird and the sad thing is that when I was with him, he had a daughter, and his daughter was not getting any education, because now Suraj was in the same place where his dad was. So that's the kind of life that he was living over there. And it's a very sad reality, but it still happens in India.
And for a lot of listeners, they may not understand or may not be aware of the caste system, which you discussed a little bit. Can you maybe share a little bit more on how that permeates society and how you saw that firsthand on your walk?
Yeah, so a caste system is something similar to what England has or what the UK has in the sense that there is a working class, there is a middle class, there is an elite class, and then there is monarchy. It's similar to that caste system where you have different castes like Brahmin, Kshatriya, Shudra, Vaishya, and then you have the final caste, which is the untouchables. But it wasn't like this forever. To start with, it was a completely different topic where if you were interested in understanding what this world is, why are we living, all these sorts of questions that we have, all these philosophical questions, then you would naturally be a Brahmin. You could go on your quest to understand life. If you were muscular and if you wanted to be in the army, then you would be Kshatriya, who were the warrior class. And it was very malleable. You can go from one caste to other. But what happened was people started misusing that and abusing that structure to a point where a king later in the era decided that whichever caste you're born in, that's the caste that you live in now. And so we have that running in India now, which is a very shrewd kind of system, which helps a few and it doesn't help the most of the people. And then you have all these nomadic people, which were instantly put into the untouchables or the lower caste, just because they were not like the people who were living in the civilized societies. So that's what caste system is like. I mean, it's still happens in India. I've seen it happening. Maybe it's not as prevalent in the urban areas now, like big cities like Mumbai, Pune. People don't really care nowadays. But when you go to the rural areas, it's still a thing. Wherever you go, it's still a thing.
And so you did this big walk. What do you feel are the biggest things you learned as part of your journey about India and, your fellow citizens?
I think first thing that I've learned is that people are much kinder in general. Like whoever you meet, everyone is just trying to be nice to you if you're nice to them. There is a lot of problem when it comes to how India is seen outside now. It feels like everyone is trying to look at or view at India as a very muscular kind of strengthy nation who is trying to stand on its legs and all that sort of stuff. But it's a very huge PR that is happening. In reality, a lot of parts in India are really, really poor. There's no infrastructure in these areas. And I just saw people still trying to make out of it, like still trying to have their best lives even when this was happening. Try to be nice, try to be generous to other people. The problem that I see is the adverse effects of technology in most of the places, because phones, TV, news is being used as propaganda. And I could see it because I was traveling from one place to other, and I could understand how things were taking shape, like what an urban person thinks and next minute what a rural person thinks. And is the gap in information, that's it, which is what makes the rural person much more inclusive, much more understanding. It's too much information that makes the urban person really hate each other. So that's what I saw from the trip.
And I read before we chatted that when you studied art in England, part of what you looked at was the social degradation through phones and television. And so did you do that in England and then in India? And can you compare and contrast those two countries? Do you see a difference?
I don't think I'm the best person to talk about this because I have no kind of research background in these subjects. But I think just as an observer, and because I got a very different view of England as an outsider living in the society during the COVID era, that there is a huge gap between the elder and the younger generation. And also because I was a mature student studying in the university, where most of the students around me were just coming out of high school. And so I saw like the changes and the shifts that were taking place when it comes to social media, how it's being used, how there is a lack of personal touch. There is a lot of things happen virtually now. Like, it's not the best thing that is happening, but I mean, it's over-sexualization of women. It's not having the right kind of connect with your peers. And at the same time, it's also information that's been given to us, fed to you, and you have no other way of looking at it other than just accepting it for what it is. And everything is just like that at this point, I feel. Like, all the media houses, wherever, whichever direction you look in, it's just the same. That's what I saw in England. Because there's no importance given to science anymore. There's no importance given to debates anymore. There's no politics left in the societies. It's not even, I don't even feel like the society is that democratic anymore. Because it's like you're being fed all that information and then you're just using it. And I think the best person that I read during this time is a Canadian professor called Marshall McLuhan, who has given the best idea of what a society would look like in the future by using technologies. And he said that Canada was just at the doorstep of America, and that's why it saw what was happening in America, and it could actually take it in and understand how to go about it and how to still keep a slow pace of life, because America was just expanding at a very different pace. But you know, that's the same thing that happened in UK. UK expanded at a very very different pace when it came to technology. And people didn't really understand how to take it in, how to understand it, to a point where everyone is just hating everyone at this point. Like, I felt that when I was living in the rural areas, in the cities, the city people hate the rural people. The rural people hate someone else. I don't understand what it is, but yeah, that's what I saw over there. And it's the same thing happening in India. It's nothing different. I think it's just overly Americanized version of the world I think we are living in, and that's what's happening in India as well. Like, when I came back to India, I saw people were much more into material things, which wasn't the case when I was leaving India, because 5 years were a huge made a huge difference in India, where people went on from having a simple lifestyle, connected to nature, connected to the roots, to having everything material out of a sudden. And yeah, that's the sort of change that I was observing.
You know, it's interesting you talk about hate, and I notice with my social media feeds, I follow outdoors people and national parks, and I'm the most boring, you know, the most boring feeds, but I keep getting these things put in that are sensationalist, that are hate, you know, they're not hate filled, but the algorithm knows that people that engage with that, they engage more. And that's, you know, the algorithm keeps trying to bring in, you know, like, I follow the National Park, Yosemite National Park and Banff National Park. That's, you know, here's what parking's going on. And I use it for information, but I can see how the algorithm keeps trying to bring in stuff that is more polarizing, because that's what gets eyeballs. And, you know, Facebook makes money by having more time on site, that gets more advertiser dollars in front of it. YouTube does the same. And it's like a willful job I have not to engage with this stuff. And I just say, I'm ultimately not, you know, not going to watch any of that. I'm just going to keep coming back and focusing on stuff that is, you know, makes me happy. But it's, you know, you just see that everything's trying to push us into, get into some hatred, get engaged, watch more videos, engage with more posts. I have no idea how to solve it. But you mentioned this Marshall McLuhan book. What's the book name for people that maybe want to have a read of it as well?
It's called Understanding Media. Understanding Media, that's the name of the book. And there's another one called Medium is the Massage. He wanted to write Medium is the Message, but somehow there was a typo and he just kept it Medium is the Massage because it keeps lulling you down and massaging you, making you feel like you're kind of ill, to a point where you're irrelevant. I think who else? Aldous Huxley wrote a lot about these things, and I think it's all just coming true. It's a very sad reality, but yeah, nevertheless.
Even something just reading books, like I find everything's trying to put into a headline or a paragraph or three paragraphs. And a lot of ideas are so complex that you miss all the nuance if you just have a paragraph. If you read 300 pages on a topic, it gives you a much more nuanced view. And, you know, I don't know many people who still read. I know lots of people who read headlines on the news or on their social media, but those like headlines have always been sensationalist. If you go back 100 years in newspapers, the headline on the top was often not the story because they wanted to get people to buy the paper. I had one more question. On a podcast, you mentioned that you saw that people were moving away from spending time in nature. And what do you think, you know, here in Canada and in North America, it feels like there's maybe a little bit of a resurgence in part of the population that's really valuing the outdoors and the benefits of that. But what did you see on your walk in terms of, were people in India still turning away from nature, and what's the impact on the average person you talked to that was not as engaged with nature?
Yeah, so maybe like a couple of decades back, people were completely living a life which was surrounded by nature. And it's definitely changing now, like I said, because of technology, because people want to have that urban lifestyle. They want to have all those material ambitions now. We know now that that's not helping us. That is why we are going back to hiking and we are going to outdoors. And, you know, we are doing all these travels because we understand that that's not the thing that is helping us. But the problem is, in India, we, as in the general kind of urban population, is trying to get these tribes and nomadic peoples who have been living that kind of a lifestyle out of that, and trying to bring them into the modern world, while we are not really telling them that these are the kind of bad sides of having a normal urban lifestyle. That you will have a lot of stress, that you will have a lot of anxieties, you will have a lot of mental issues, which these people don't have or didn't have for a long time. And I still feel like a lot of people who are living in a close vicinity to nature don't have all these mental issues because they have a place to shake it off. They can go out on a walk and they forget about it. But when you're living in a city, it's just impossible because the structure is not built in that way. And you're just living in a kind of a mechanical world. It's a completely mechanized world now. Maybe England would be an exception because there's lots of gardens. I loved going to gardens. But I still feel like it's not nature as in nature, as in the wild kind of nature that used to be, because there's nothing wild left in most of the parts. Whereas in India, there is a lot of wildness left in most of the parts. But bringing these people out of that is a very... it's a very difficult game that we are playing with ourselves, at least here in India, where these are the people who are actually helping nature to stay as it is by living there and not by cutting it down and not by doing all these sort of things that we are doing in the urban areas. But I think if we bring them to the urban areas, they're just going to be like Aborigines at the end of the day, who... got into a very different world that the English built in Australia, and they didn't know, there was a huge gap between the way of their life and the way of the people who started living in that place. So it's just, I think we are not able to share that information. Like, we need to get some information from them as well, who have a lot more experience of living in those places than we have as urban people. And maybe we can learn a lot from them. That's what I learned from this entire journey, that there is a lot more wisdom still left in a lot of tribes. It's just that we are not being able to connect with them, because somehow I feel like we all feel like we are superior to them in some way. And so we need to tell them what to do rather than, getting some ideas from them as well.
That's a great message to end the podcast on. I want to thank you for coming on the show today, Ash. It was really fascinating to hear about this other side of India that, you know, so many of us have never experienced and likely will never experience.
Yeah, thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Your book comes out in April, I believe. Where can people find it?
It's on my website. You can pre-order it on my website. I think it will take some time to come on Kindle and Amazon, but I think you can pre-order it on my website right now.
And I'll put a link to the website in the show notes. I think you said it comes out on the 20th of April. So it's ashutoshjoshi.in, but check the show notes so you get the perfect spelling. And with that, thanks for listening to this episode of the 10 Adventures podcast. We'll be back next week to explore the world and hear about more epic adventures. Start planning your own adventure by visiting us at 10adventures.com and listen to other episodes of the 10 Adventures podcast on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you find your podcasts.